I've titled this The Elusive Search, or The Elusive Quest for Reconciliation of Northern Uganda. Phil Clark, in his opening comments, talked about there's been much debate about justice versus reconciliation, reconciliation versus the ICC and so forth in Northern Uganda. I don't intend to engage that debate directly, but to try to unpack a little bit of what I see as really quite fascinating set of experiences and dynamics in Northern Uganda. And I'll start with a story. Two clans were based in respective huts, about 100 meters apart, joined by a straight path. The path would be traversed repeatedly as the ceremony proceeded. Several elders laid a large stick across the middle of the path, while members of each clan approached the stick from their respective hut, each delegation leading a sheep, one brown and one black. Three men from each of the groups removed their shirts and shoes and were given short sticks, which they used to recreate a fight scene, the two sides standing opposite each other and beating the larger stick across the path that was held by the elders. Four times they attacked, with bits of wood flying on the people who closely clustered around. Then the elders declared that the time for fighting is done, and the sheep were brought forward and laid on the ground side by side, head to tail. Each sheep was stabbed in the heart region and then quickly chopped in half with pangas. The elders caught some of the blood from each sheep in a wooden bowl containing shredded bark from the oak tree. The remainder of the blood from the two sheep formed a single pool on the path. A small amount of material from the large intestines was added to the bowl. It was an ugly, powerful, very evocative sight. A fight scene followed by blood, guts, severed carcasses, and a crimson pool of blood flowing down a pathway. And I debated within myself whether to start my presentation with this story, as it can too easily be construed as a sort of simple anthropological kind of portrayal of a quaint cultural practice from somewhere far away from the place where we're sitting and talking, right? But I decided to use it as a starting point, because I think this scene of blood and guts is an apt metaphor for many of the armed conflicts that have ravaged Uganda since it achieved independence in 1962. A particular concern in my presentation today is the civil war between the government of Uganda and the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, that has plagued much of the northern Uganda over the past two decades. And as with many civil wars, the one between the government and the LRA has been waged up close and personal, including combatants killing, torturing, kidnapping people from their own communities or tribe. Most residents have been forced from their homes and livelihoods. 1.5 million people were displaced with their homes destroyed. Many were forced to spend years in crowded, squalid encampments for internally displaced persons. It's a story that I know some of you in the room are very familiar with and know more than I do. Upwards of 30,000 people were abducted to serve as fighters or porters for the LRA. Many of them children. Uncounted thousands of people have died. Many more tortured or maimed. The economy, region in shambles. And what strikes one as you live there is that everyone in the region is war affected. including a wide swath of the Chole and Lenni and the Tessie people. A series of peace talks hosted in Sudan resulted in cessation of hostilities in 2006, allowing growing freedom of movement, some sense of normalcy for the first time in years. But whether this will turn into a permanent peace agreement remains to be seen. But whether the shooting stops now or in the future, a persistent question remains. What is the way forward? How do people recover, live together again, after violence and trauma suffered at the hands of their fellow citizens? How do people respond when meeting on the street? Those who are responsible for atrocities. Is justice possible in such a situation? And if so, what in the world does it mean? Is reconciliation at an individual, community, or national level possible? And if so, what in the world does it look like? The Klan brothers, reenacting that fight in Gua District last year, were participating in what the Chole people call Mato Oput, drinking the root of the Oput tree. After the sheep were slaughtered, the blood was put in the bowl along with some additional liquid. The mixture stirred and placed on the path near that pool of blood. Pairs of men from each clan then knelt, facing each other, the bowl between them. An elder took the heads of the pair and bumped them together, knocked them together four times. And then the brother from the offending clan bent forward, hands clasped behind his back, and drank from the bowl four times. The brother from the victim's clan then leaned forward four times and drank. This head bumping and drinking process repeated then with the other two pairs of clan brothers. But the Oput tree was chosen, or is chosen, because the root, the bark of the root, has its incredibly bitter taste. And the men who serve as the clan surrogates in the Mato Oput ceremony are expected to tell their relatives not to fight again, to tell them that this stuff, this vile mixture of blood and bark and guts, this tastes so awful, let us resolve never to kill again. A man from each clan carried the slaughtered sheep towards their respective huts. Each clan received a front half and a back half, a brown half and a black half. So it's now the meat is all cooked and mixed together. The men go to their huts, the opposite end of the path, to butcher and prepare the meat, and the women from both groups stood together and chatted. That's the end of the pictures. A year and a half earlier, two people had gotten into a fight, resulting in an inadvertent death. And through discussion with the police, it had been decided that the case would be handled through traditional process. A chief had presided over the discussions between the clan representatives in which the offense was presented and was acknowledged. Subsequent negotiations determined the amount of money that the offending clan would pay as civil compensation. And the money was delivered to the chief in installments over several months. This all took a period of time, a year and a half. Now the payments have been completed. The ceremony was being held. The ceremony was being held to celebrate that a process of dialogue and reconciliation had taken place. And in an hour or so, when the meat was ready, everybody would feast together. Today, there would be meat, and not just meat from one sheep, but from two. An extravagant indulgence in that time and place to have that much meat. It is party time. Relationships had been restored. People were celebrating. Well, those of you who have been in the region or have read the literature have seen a lot of debate about Mato Oput. To what extent does this traditional practice, or a practice such as this, for addressing a killing, offer a way to deal with the atrocities of contemporary war? The blood and the gore that culminates the metal negotiations highlights a sort of universal quandary about how to respond to an evil act. Does one focus on destroying the evil or trying to incapacitate the evildoer, or does one attempt to focus on attempting to heal or to mitigate the injury arising from the loathsome act? How, as Judith just said, do we understand justice and also reconciliation? In reflecting this debate, this quandary, many Ugandans have promoted Meadowfoot and other traditional practices of cleansing and justice-making as a primary way forward for this incredible morass of history that they have lived through. Others have argued strenuously that this is inappropriate, that this amounts to sort of slap on the wrist impunity for war criminals who must be prosecuted and punished in order for justice to be accomplished. And of course, there is also a small but influential number of people who seek neither reconciliation nor retribution, but for a variety of reasons are prepared to keep the fighting, the resentments, and the fears alive. So while there's no consensus in Northern Uganda about what should be done, or what should be the relative emphasis on reconciliation versus prosecution and punishment, I've been intrigued with this discussion there and the persistence of the calls for reconciliation in Northern Uganda for a couple reasons. One is that conflict theorists will describe reconciliation as part of any comprehensive peace process, rebuilding process. But in most cases, reconciliation is described as a goal to be pursued after the fighting has stopped, after the shooting has ended. One of the things that makes the study of reconciliation in Northern Uganda so intriguing to me is the fact that the extent to which Ugandans have called for reconciliation, and been promoting that, even before a peace of agreement is signed, even before there was a cessation of hostilities. This has been true of certain NGOs that have emerged in the region, local NGOs, to address the consequences of war, certain elected officials, many Ugandan academics. I want to say that these calls for reconciliation, as I mentioned, should not be construed in any way as reflecting a unanimous view or a cultural consensus. The surveys and interviews done in Northern Uganda reflect a large number of victimized people who favor retributive approaches. But yet the persistence of calls for reconciliation at the height of the violence is nevertheless, to me, very striking. And another thing that intrigues me is the fact that many of the people promoting reconciliation there, some of the most consistent proponents, are indeed people who have been the ones most affected most directly by the violence, the ones who have lost their family members, close friends, and so forth. And in fact, a very significant group, Concerned Parents Association, that's really a victims group, self-help group, parents of kids who are abducted, formed, has had throughout its operations a very strong reconciliation ethic and ethos, consistently calling for that. And so these questions I've had is, what is it? How is reconciliation understood in this region? And why? Why the persistence? And so that's what I'm trying to explore here in the next few minutes, and also then offer at the end perhaps a bit of a hypothesis of what I see. I'm trying not as much as possible to layer on some interpretation, although admittedly we all do that, but rather to, based on conversations over the course of about 6 months with a wide variety of community leaders, local officials, traditional customary priests, educators, religious leaders, and so forth, to explore what is it that they have understood and meant about reconciliation. And reconciliation, according to the people I've interviewed, needs to be personal. There's this debate about, is it personal or is it something on a political level? International Center for Transitional Justice, for example, some would say reconciliation is a political thing, it's not about some psychological or some subjective state of mind. But according to the people that I've talked to in this war affected region, it needs to reconciliation needs to address not only the political, but also very specific relationships. And the same is true for those I've talked to who have committed atrocities, many of whom acted under extreme duress, threatened with punishment or with their own death if they did not abuse community members. Although some hope to enter civilian society quietly without attracting too much attention, or specifically acknowledging the harm that they have done, others do seek some way to be forgiven by victims, to be reconciled. Thus, in the interviews that I've done, I've heard that reconciliation, in this instance stemming from a prolonged civil conflict, is multifaceted, with action required at the interpersonal, as well as at the community and national level. A variety of ceremonies and processes are used here, and I'm not going to go into detail them, but if I were, it was often described as a sequence. Perhaps people, one ceremony, one process to welcome people back home after they've been away or after they've been engaged in war, to cleanse them from the contamination that they would be bringing back from the community, to cleanse them from the unclean spirits, to say, you're now welcome back to be among us. But that's just like an open door. It's coming back. It's not saying everything is forgiven. It's not the reconciliation process. It's just putting out the welcome mat, as it were, to begin the process of then looking at what makes sense and seeing what needs to be done. People also spoke very much about the importance of reconciliation at a national level. Since its independence in 62, there have been no fewer than 30 armed conflicts in Uganda, with hundreds of thousands of deaths. And often the slaughter and upheaval of one war has simply led to the next in a tit-for-tat fashion. Yet with very little public acknowledgement of most of these wars or the resulting deaths or dislocations. The current government, led by President Museveni, has been in power since 1986, when it seized control after several years of Bush fighting. And the heavy losses that Museveni's army inflicted in the Luwero Triangle are regularly noted by the government in public discourse as part of their war of liberation, their hero sort of worship of the will, without any mention of the civilians who were killed or dislocated by their army. Similarly, in northern Uganda, there are, you'll remember markers, monuments that record massacres by the LRA, but there are no markers, or at least none that I've seen, I've heard about, no markers for the places where atrocities were committed by the government soldiers. Is that a signal to hurry up? Okay. And so a coalition of a wide variety of organizations have advocated for a national process of reconciliation and drafted legislation for that, for a reconciliation bill. It's doubtful what will happen with that. It's simply to say it's there. But in the absence of a transition, and this is one of the challenging things about Uganda, I say, the Museveni government has been there since 86, there hasn't been a transition. So can you even talk about transitional government or transitional justice when there's been no transition and when one of the current parties is quite happy with many aspects of the status quo? Let's try to summarize then a few things coming out of my interviews in terms of understandings of reconciliation. In some ways it's easiest to describe what reconciliation is not. It's not a step-by-step recipe. It does not result simply from following formulas or rituals. Although ritual and symbol hold great power, such as in some of the scenes that I portray, those who have made it their business in the local communities to study these traditions emphasize that they're not synonymous with reconciliation. They're either an aid to reconciliation or they're a celebration of the reconciliation of some process that has already occurred. Reconciliation does not come quickly or as a one-time event. It's often an ongoing process of reflection. In the same way, reconciliation processes are not static. Some have argued that taking traditional practices such as these and employing them in widespread cases, there isn't enough of that. You can't do that. That's very true. But it's just as true that criminal prosecutions were never meant to be employed for cases of thousands and thousands or whatever. And so the one example of Kakacha provides an interesting experience of taking traditional process, modifying it. The Gacaca since the 94 massacre doesn't look like it did traditionally, but it borrows on it and is trying to do something on a widespread scale. Reconciliation is not perfect. It's clear to anybody that reconciliation, like justice, is seldom complete. We can talk about justice as if it is something that is fully complete, fully knowable. Rarely do we get the same reconciliation. Reconciliation is not to be equated with forgiveness or amnesty, people tell me. Forgiveness, like its political manifestation, amnesty involves canceling a debt or relinquishing some entitlement. However, while forgiveness is sometimes part of a reconciliation process, it's not a necessary component. It's not easy, it's not unilateral, and it's not about maintaining or returning to the status quo. Human rights abuses in northern Uganda and other places, other forms of grievous injury change contexts, they change people, they change relationships. And so as I talk to people, they say reconciliation is not about going back, but it necessarily involves discovering and shaping a new kind of relationship. Why this persistence? One of the reasons is that people are sick and tired of violence. After 20 years of insecurity and instability, people simply want to be left alone. And I heard that frequently. And somebody used the term reconciliation for sort of a live and let live. As long as you don't bother me, I won't bother you. That's just okay. They also seek it some because they see the enemy as not just the LRA, but also the government. The government has not failed to protect, cannot be trusted. So therefore, we have to talk directly with the LRA because we don't trust the government to do this for us. The government's unlikely to end the war. Some preach reconciliation because they see it as an opportunity to assert and create a political role for themselves, to build their power base. And some accuse the traditional chiefs and customary leaders of this, which may be true, but doesn't necessarily make their motivations for reconciliation any less sincere. Some spoke of it in terms of building and strengthening a more African system rather than a colonial or post-colonial. And finally, the hypothesis that I offer coming out of this, as I sort of looked at this, one of the things that stood out in my mind that I'm toying with more is the notion that perhaps part of what shapes whether people look at whether reconciliation is either desirable or appropriate, and whether they seek it, is shaped by one's worldview, that is, by one's ultimate sense of reality. If I had more time, I could talk more about the religious reality of that part of the region and the spiritual worldview, but I won't do that. But very often, but simply say that for many people, they do not hold a materialist worldview. There's a spiritual reality. And if I kill somebody or somebody, that body is not buried properly, the chen, the spirits are very well, very much likely to haunt me, and so forth. And so in a matter of put process, into the reconciliation process, you can have different motivations at play. One of them may come out of such a spiritualist worldview or a Christian worldview. And other people look at the world and say, that's not the world. What's real is these things that we can touch and replicate. Another part of worldviews has to do with understanding reality is how independent, how autonomous are we, how interconnected, how communal, how individualistic. And as I looked at some of these things around cultural understandings and people's sense of what's real, family, clan, the importance of clan, spirits, all this, or individual, law, modernity, some of what people began to say fell into to shape for me, and that the extent to which one sees reconciliation as possible, desirable, hypothesis is, has something to do with the extent to which one sees basic life as interconnected. Is it, as the speaker said in the previous session, that the sword that's held up all cuts one flesh, or are we different, or are we separate from one another? Are we joined, or are we not? And so this is what I want to explore with further in future work, in terms of looking more about people's basic concepts of worldview, which I suspect plays into the sense of, is reconciliation an imperative, an option? Is it necessary? Is it possible? Is it naive? Is it stupid? All these sorts of things, I think, are reflections on some more basic understandings about what's real and what's important in life. I think I've taken a bit extra time. I apologize for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor, for the powerful, in every sense, presentation.